This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
In 2009, Aaron saw a show that Gene and I put together at the Cantor Fitzgerald Gallery at Haverford College called Imaginative Feats, Literally Presented, Three Works for Video Projection. The catalogs of that exhibition are available here. Please take them. They're excellent ways of balancing an unstable table. They are exactly the right thickness for doing so, and they're quite lovely. Ellen Gould designed them, and they're beautiful works. He asked us almost immediately upon seeing that show to do something at Slot, and here is that something, a conversation not about our work per se, but about the issues raised by it. We want the works we've installed in the gallery here, first Flatland, which has been running and which we can run again, and Lost, which is a single channel projection which will run at the end of the evening, is in the other space. We want these to function as props and tools. They're objects not only to think about but also to think with, and we would be honored if thinking with them can prove generative. So consider Flatland and Lost as but one way to engage with what? Engage with archives. And we can talk about that. And Okaja wants us and has demanded that we go off script and talk precisely about Flatland because she's moved by it. And when Kaja moves, I then move along with her, as some of you probably are learning. That is a really good idea. So that these are pieces are one way of dealing with archives, and they're all built out of archives. They're stitched together out of archives, photographs, captions, and in the case of Lost, a radio broadcast. So it's the materials, the artifacts that matter most to us. In particular, in this case, pictures of pictures. I want to talk about a picture of a drawing and what that is, and a picture of a photograph, and how we engage with that, and what they're for, what they do, what we call upon them to do. And so I have a line here that says, delay, Kaja takes over. So we're going to then go back on script, but maybe not, because, you know.
Maybe not.
So Kaja.
I thought everybody would be very disappointed if we didn't have a chance to talk about these two works because they're so suggestive in so many different ways, and also not move too quickly to subsume them to this larger archive question because the specificity of them is very rich. And Brian also has done a work in San Francisco based on war games, people who reenact battles. And so I thought we should just, it is Veterans Day, dwell a little bit in that terrain. And Gene and John wanted me to ask them, and so of course I am.
So this is now our script?
To talk a bit about where the material came from and how they put it together, because there's a surprising backstory.
I'm going to let Gene answer that first question. How Flatland?
Where did the text and the images?
The images came from searches that are part of, I think, our artistic practice, where we look always at what photographs are doing in the culture and how photographs are being utilized throughout culture. And so that's just part of our practice, is looking at archives of images and how they function. And we came upon these two groups of photographs. And first we came across the Flat Daddies. And, you know, they're, as with anyone that looks at them, they become an amazing way of understanding how people create proxy family members when family members leave. But it wasn't until we found the Flat Stanley photographs that we began thinking more concisely about how people use these re-photographic images to send to and from war as a way to replace family members who are absent. And the narration that is part of the projection that you see tonight is drawn from everything is pretty much verbatim from a collection of various testimonials on how the families have used the Flat Stanleys and the Flat Daddies in their family lives. So the Flat Stanley there were multiple, there's many, many Stanleys, and many, many Stanleys go very many places all over the world, and they tend to be created almost exclusively from school projects, and then they get sent. But we focus specifically on the Stanleys that were sent overseas to the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also those that were sent into the political arena of the White House. So all of the text comes from the captions that were from these photographs. And with the Flat Daddies, all of the text comes from the testimonials of the family members who use the Flat Daddies, but it's not one voice, it's a cumulative voice of people who use the Flat Daddies in their family life to make present their missing family members.
So I guess my first more theoretical question is has to do with this generic notion of the Flat Daddy. It almost has a Lacanian ring, like the symbolic father, only it's the Flat Daddy, and it's such an astonishing concept in its implications for fatherhood, not just for the issue of photographs and proxy existence, but fatherhood and what we want in fathers, whether this isn't the most satisfying kind of father you can have, and the persistence of these
features. Wait, whether it can be?
Whether it isn't in its purely symbolic presence and silence, more satisfyingly daddy than any three-dimensional daddy could ever be. But you don't have to talk about that if you don't want to. But just
I think there's reference in the kids who use Flat Daddies did make reference in a lot of the texts that we read about that relationship between the absent father and the flat father, and how in some ways the flat father was more available and more satisfying. The wives generally had a very different feeling. For the wives, it tended to be much more problematic.
Oh, we'll talk about that. That's really interesting.
No, go ahead. Keep going on a thread, because it's part of the narrative material for the Flat Daddies. I mean, it makes that point. It makes that point that putting him away begins to become an important, being able to put him away. And also,
you mean that he can be put away?
He can be put away. He can actually think bad things can happen to him. He can break. He needs to be repaired. But I want you to actually, Jean, I want you to fill out what your recollection of that distinction between the way that the mothers talk about their deployment in the home versus the way the kids talk about them.
I think over time, what most families found was over time the relationship to the Flat Daddies became empty. Its initial presence within the family was significant and did provide meaning and provided
for the women,
for the mothers and the children.
Well, women as mothers, women like imagining what, trying to imagine what it might be to repair an irreparable severance. Like this is, and but not because they quote unquote fall for it or fall into very deeply, but only by in relation to the children that they imagine, probably successfully are imagining, can play with this father in a way that as children do, or I know that's not daddy, but nonetheless.
Yeah, right.
The mothers tend to do it for the children rather than for themselves, which I think, but then they have a responsibility for this object.
Right.
That and there's also always the threat that the father may not come home, and what do you do with the object? Or he'll come home in some irreparable way, and so that preys tended to prey upon some of the narratives that we read. That constant sort of anxiety around the image.
And
I think it's the same anxiety that we as viewers have about those images. I mean, I think that the family members...
Body.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
I mean, it's the anxiety that's produced in us that's often met, I think, by people who see the images with kind of an ironic distance or a kind of sort of a laugh at the very gesture itself. And
it's like double amputees. But also, I think it has such, I think one of the reasons why this work is so rich is that we are dealing with veterans returning whose lives have been utterly and absolutely shattered and who can't find their way back into their families again. And the, yeah, John.
No, I think that the reason why we work so hard to, in some sense, flatten the piece as well, to flatten the affect on both sides of the screen, is for all of that the absent narratives. This is one, like what we imagine, we can imagine who's coming back or what's coming back, and the who and the what are not, could never meet the idealization that is that photographic proxy, yeah, that's there, that can be present in a way as, and present and immutable in a way that daddy can never be. And so I think in making the piece, we were hoping that would be part of its mystery, like what is the blind field of this work? What's outside of the frame that's not being spoken to directly? I mean, that's what.
Yeah, that's what's kind of incredible to me. That I mean, when you listen to the comments of both, you know,
the boy and the mom,
boy and the mom, that this object could be invested with anything. To an outsider, it just seems utterly preposterous that this cutout could actually hold any kind of mechanism of response and any kind of emotion.
Well, but the fact, I don't know about that, because I think we are all like desperate to invest all sorts of things. And it's just not, I mean, for you or for me, it may not be that, but we have our, like, don't touch my fantasy, but I can crush yours.
Yeah,
like
I think that's what's interesting, that in terms of just this as a form of depiction,
yeah,
that, you know, and in terms of thinking of, like, pictorial representation, I mean, you often think of pictorial representing, it represents by the depiction itself, but here, clearly, there's a form of representation that is, it's more like a trigger mechanism that's triggering a whole, you know, set of complex feelings and ideas on the part of family members, but then to the outsiders, none of that happens. And it's kind of interesting that this object can actually produce that. And I think it says something about the nature of representation itself. I think you could even spread it to how contemporary art functions, that, you know, that you need, you have dedicated audiences that have special interests at stake.
Just to add one more element into that, with both the Stanleys and the Daddies, we're cognizant or interested, and not just in those image archives, but in images that are produced in order to send them away. Like, these images are produced, so it's a complex transaction, right? The photograph of the flat daddy in the home with the child is produced in order to send that photograph to the father who's serving overseas in order to tell that father that he is in some sense still present. So the photographs are doing a job that is similar but distinct from the job that flat daddy is supposed to be doing in the home. The photographs that we found are photographs that are meant to be sent away and that then are to do work for the witness, for a weird sort of witnessing of, I am there still. Like, oh, look, I'm still there. Or I'm not. It could also psychically function as the proof that I'm not needed or I'm not there. Or, you know, that photograph of me is there, but I'm not. So yeah, it's complicated, and the Stanleys
which
too.
Which I think, I want to just reiterate that it's more important that the photograph of the flat photograph is then re-photographed,
right,
and it is the fact that mm-hmm. re-photograph may travel and do work, and that's even more important than the taking of the flat reproduction of the father to the grocery store, wherever they take it. It's really about taking it to the grocery store and being photographed with it in the grocery store and then sending that photograph overseas. And it's that work that I think is compelling. And it's the same work in some ways that the flat Stanley does, but the inverse.
Which is why we paired them, because the Stanleys are sent by children here to fathers who are then like, look, you're here, or he's here, your friend is here, and I will photograph him here and prove to you. There's that indexical bit of, it was real, he's really here. Of course, but what's really here is not the boy. At least in Flat Stanley, the fable is operative in a way that with the fathers it's not.
So a few questions. I think this hour is not going to be nearly enough time to talk about these works.
Well, we only have another minute to talk about this.
Yes, we do. Yes, we have.
Gosh,
15 minutes, John.
Yes,
so obviously you're playing with the notion of flatness by having a two-sided screen. But the two works feel very different to me. In spite of
because
that.
You're calling them two works, and it's really one.
All right.
Go ahead.
All right, well,
no,
okay.
It's fine, but that means that they're two for you.
I can't well, I guess they are, Joe. I guess they are. Well, no, you perhaps can talk me out, but I don't know that anybody wants to sit through that tedious process.
I'm sure they would love to hear that. But no, go ahead.
So question number one, can there be a flat mommy? Question number two, does everybody always refer to the simulacrum father as the flat daddy as opposed to our flat daddy? Or
There are flat mothers.
There are far fewer
flat mothers than there are flat fathers, but they do exist, and there are representations of them. They're not plentiful.
And there's one in the piece.
There is one in the piece.
Also used by vet, used in military.
Yeah, it's a soldier that was. In
but it looks like in that context that it's her mother holding her.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So whether it's a flat mommy, like any. I now want to say any man becomes a dad. I don't.
Well, you don't say the daddy, the mother, unless you're talking about their parents in the third person when they're absent. But hello, flat daddy, or let's go to bed now, the flat daddy. There's some very bizarre linguistic objectification.
Well, the families do refer. They don't refer to the object as daddy. They refer to it as flat daddy, and it's always daddy. It's not flat father.
Yeah.
Within the vocabulary.
There's another version too. There's the daddy on a stick. Have you run across?
I have. Yeah.
So
yeah.
They put the flat daddy on a giant popsicle stick and carry it around, and the kids call it daddy on a stick. So. Kaja, where do you go with that?
They're also little daddy dolls that are made of cloth.
Uh-huh.
And it's a tiny little doll that baby can play with. But those don't seem to have been as...
They're not doing the work that these flat daddy photographs are in terms of this... and in a large part, the way they're sent is not through the mail. They're sent through the internet. That's where they live. The soldiers see themselves flattened on the computer in the internet. They don't get sent paper photographs anymore.
I see. So
it's really about an internet exchange of images. Yeah.
So with the flat Stanleys, they're not photographic, right? They're drawn.
The Stanleys are drawn.
They're drawn. They're sometimes colored in. It looks like that. Clipping an actual illustration and then coloring it in. But the ones that are, if you can see the screen, are handmade top to bottom.
And they have their origin in a children's book series.
Correct.
Do you want to just share that with the audience?
So good at this.
Well, there was a book called Flat Stanley. It came out in
70, someone else?
No, earlier. 40.
It's at least 20 years old.
Yeah, no, it's older. I think it's earlier than the 70s. But in any case, there was one school teacher who read the book with her class and then decided that she would create the first flat Stanley and actually and created a protocol for other classrooms to become engaged in the Flat Stanley Project. So it became a very frequent project to be done in the classroom setting in the elementary school, usually around third grade.
It seems, weirdly, the Flat Stanley seems to mobilize more a much fuller paternal fantasy that... this little surrogate child or friend is sent off to be taken care of on the front in Iraq or Afghanistan. And then the whole fantasy is the attention lavished on this figure, the love shown. In other words, it's not nearly as flat an experience of fatherhood. It seems to be rooted much more through the child's imagination, too. What do you think?
Right. Well, as well as the father's imagination in you know, because it's actually the dad that takes the flat Stanley of his son and brings the son to war with him, takes him out on missions, and goes out and teaches him to do push-ups and how to shoot a gun.
For the child back home, do you think, or?
Yes, to share the as a methodology for a shared experience in, you know, when separated by vast numbers of miles as well as, you know, condition.
When I saw our great President George Bush and his fabulous Condoleezza Rice there with Flat Stanley, I thought, flat president. You know how every photograph of George Bush always had that same smirk and always looked absolutely unreal, like a, you know, flat figure.
Right.
We actually had a lot of arguments about whether or not to include those photographs of Bush, and because, I mean, I think that Bush...
I can't remember who had what position.
I didn't want to, and you wanted to.
And why?
Yeah, why didn't I want?
Because I mean, I won't talk for you, John.
You might as well, because I'm not going to be able to object. I have no recollection.
But I was very hesitant because, you know, I think when you become very specific about specific political figures, you know, time moves very quickly, and already, you know, I can't even remember who Condoleezza Rice was. Well, I mean, I can, but, you know, my daughter, who's 16, you know, that's not going to be a present figure for her. So what John and I settled on in this discussion and this dialogue was to only use the photographs that really made sure that it wasn't so much about Bush, but it indicated government and White House. You know, I mean, it was more important for me that it was... that it was about how the government had participated within this flat Stanley program, and less so
well,
than.
But also, it's the appearance of that governmentality, that
correct.
Agency, which on the other side of the screen is nowhere visible. So it's
right.
It was important. I mean, for me now, I can make up something about why it mattered to me. But my experience of it now is that it's very odd to see them as no longer present tense, but having a kind of iconic power that's a residue of potency that continues to operate.
They do, strangely.
Yeah.
And it's not do. Over...
You could have been right and I could have been wrong.
It makes me think a little bit of Paul Chan's Read the Operation. I know that Karen is teaching a course on animation, art and animation, and taught that work, which I love, right. But it... There are some affinities between the flat Stanley and that. However, that is not the topic.
Can I just bring up something too? That I think it's...
And then I want to switch, actually, because I want Brian to have an opportunity to narrate for us this extraordinary work that you
Okay, just
produced.
A minute, though. I want to ask John...
Brian
okay.
can speak.
Okay, Brian's going to speak, and then I'm going to ask Brian about his project before we talk about yours.
Oh,
new
touché.
Ideas.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Oh gosh, what was I going to say now?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
So including Bush. I was really happy to see that in there because this is a phenomenon that occurred as a result of two wars that were started by this guy. I mean, it's not like you can
Absolutely.
Really extract him from the kind of sociological construct around this phenomenon.
Right.
And I think there's something to be said about the particularity of how these wars were started, you know, what is the phenomenology of the war for the people participating in it? I mean, there's all this talk about, you know, the 1% and the 99% with Occupy Wall Street, but it also applies to
Absolutely.
The military and those who have not served in the military right. with respect to these two wars.
Right.
And I think one of the, if you look at the comments around a lot of the Flat Daddy photographs, a lot of the comments are about thanking the people who came up with this whole program for doing it because the families are so forgotten, as including the fighting people in Iraq. And then, of course, the families at home are like doubly forgotten and that's a tragedy in their eyes and they're thanking everybody for putting a focus on this, on people who have actually offered to fight America's battles.
And it's bizarre that everybody's white, because most of the military, most people in the military are African American or Latino or minority in some other sense.
I don't think we found a single African American soldier. Most of these are from Maine National Guard, which is where the Flat Daddies, Maine National Guard unit. I have no idea what the demographic breakdown of that National Guard unit is, but that in the ones that we were able to find, that's what we found.
Thinking about race and also class, because there seems to be some aspiration towards middle classness that is secured or that gets crystallized around the Flat Daddy figure, that if he's in his place, the family will be stable somehow. And of course, African American families don't have that kind of promise of stability very often. So there's a follow-up project for you, John.
And just now, for me? Only for me?
Well, I can't. Jean was never my student, so I can't order her
it's
around.
Only me. Right, okay. That makes sense. All right.
Unless but she wants
if,
me to.
If you had come out to support me while I was talking to Judith, you would have seen the Hank Willis Thomas Unbranded project as part of that.
You mean that?
No, we're not going to do that today.
But I think that the invisibility of the war and the way the communities of people who are participating in the war and who aren't participating in the war is very, I mean, I know a few people, but not many, and certainly my community at large is not involved in the military. I think that the reality of the military has been, I mean, this that these were when we found these photographs, in essence, these were the only photographs of the war that I had really, really seen. These Flat Stanley photographs. We have not been allowed to see, and it's not part of my particular community. And so the fact that pretty much this seemed to represent at this time, represented the way the war had been mediated most powerfully.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very telling, that the war was mediated most powerfully through these images rather than actual images of conflict.
Well, particularly the war as it has any kind of presence and visibility here.
Right.
Which is
quite different than its visibility
private and domestic,
there.
Yes. Private and domestic, and circuited through the anxieties of family and the brokenness of those families.
And I think that's why you have a visual production of this kind that looks so tightly framed and formulated and with such continuity from image to image.
That's
it's like
amazing.
Somebody cut out sitting at a dinner table or on a swing or in a living room or on a couch. I mean, that is the array of locations for this Flat Daddy pretty much. And I think, I don't know, I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that there's just a larger social context, which is actually constructing these images in this very narrow and limited way. And I think it has something to do with the fact that Americans don't want to really think about the fact that we've been involved in these two wars and that they've been like largely unproductive, and the war in Iraq was sort of a fabrication of the upper levels of our government, and that it's created like an incredible tragedy in Iraq that every American should be like highly aware of, and are not, you know.
Which is a good place to switch over to looking at having you narrate for us, present a little bit of the project that you've been working on.
Well, later Brian will be put on the hot seat.
No, you can do that. You can do that right now.
Yeah, please. Gosh, I've been waiting for my turn.
All right. Well, okay. Just say something quickly about your project so people know.
Fast.
Yeah.
Tight.
Yeah.
Okay. So this project started in 2007, and it was, you know, when George Bush was still in office, and I kind of looked around the art world and noticed that there weren't many projects really addressing the war in Iraq, and I thought, I just felt kind of ethically compelled to try to come up with some formulation. And so I decided to do something about Iraq directly, but I thought that it would be problematic for me to express my own feelings, my own ideas about the war. I don't think there is a public out there that would be necessarily interested in that. And so I decided to set up a kind of charge situation that could look at the war in Iraq from this oblique angle, so kind of come at it from the side rather than head on. And what I decided to do was to involve a community of people who think a lot about war and war strategy. And I found these guys online who fight historical battles with little toy soldiers on miniature dioramas. And this is like an incredibly dedicated community, and one that is all over the United States. There's an enormous number of people who have this as their primary hobby and are deeply involved in it. And so I invited them to participate in a performance project of mine in which I asked them to play the war in Iraq on a diorama of their building and play an event that was happening at the moment that the game was happening. So I assembled a team of Arabic-speaking researchers who went online and found out what was happening in Iraq that day, and then the game was structured according to this event that these researchers found. Do I need to say more?
Yeah.
More? Okay, so it's a game, it's a game of, it has a chance element in it, so the scenario that the game began with was an actual event in Iraq. There was a kidnapping of a German woman and her son, Hannelore Kraus. And so that set up the course of events for the game. But the game proceeds both by war strategy and by the structure of this initiating event. But then dice come into play. Dice are rolled, and it tells the individual players how they can move across the table. So it's a combination of, you know, kind of real life actual events colliding with chance, and then the fantasy of game playing all sort of colliding on top of each other at the same time.
And those wonderful melted, were they G.I. Joe figures that you had in the Yerba Buena show? Is that what they were?
They were portraits of the toy soldiers blown up to 5 feet. So the miniature soldiers are only about an inch and a half. Mm-hmm. And I actually didn't manipulate them at all in taking the photographs. I just put a close-up lens on the soldier and shot it. But when that was blown up to 5 feet tall, then all these distortions came out. And then there all of this kind of emotional atmosphere got embedded into the photograph.
I mean, when I watch this clip and think about the piece, I didn't have the opportunity to see it or engage the performance, I immediately, you know, think of the people that you have conscripted to play and to look over and to witness. I begin to think of them and to take pleasure in the game. I immediately begin to be horrified by my own interest in how it turned out. How did it turn out? What does winning and losing in the game mean vis-a-vis winning and losing in the referentially never distant space of Iraq on this particular day when you knew that on this day something had unfolded? It's a very bizarre...
And I also remember that it didn't go according to plan for you, that... Right? You remember that part of, I'm sure, better than I ever
could. It was traumatic, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, it was really interesting because it was a collaboration between me and this group of gamers. And as the collaboration unfolded, we all came to hate each other. So it was a collaboration in which collaborators did not really want to work with each other, and it caused its own internal chaos, and there was all this dissension, and each time this thing was played, it nearly collapsed.
But you were saying before that that had to do with the fact that they were really uncomfortable playing out. I mean, what was the gamer who said, it's too, we don't play, what was the rule? We don't play
present tense conflicts because they don't want there to be any kind of identification between a soldier on the table and an actual soldier in the world who might have gotten killed or
wouldn't it be nice if that were the rule of the Pentagon where we're not going to let this unfold because these actually could be people. We're not going to game this out and do a quantitative assessment of the likely costs because these could all be people. I mean, I think of those thoughts when I'm watching these masterminds work on either side of a conflict. They are immediately, for me, identified with the Bush White House, with the Pentagon, and with the larger structural components of that militarism has produced culturally.
I mean, the Arabic-speaking researchers that I had on in the game as well were graduate students of mine from Cairo. And they were hammering me about the project for years. I almost didn't complete it because they said, look, you're taking this extremely serious situation that's absolutely tragic and you're mapping a game structure on top of it. Isn't that just morally corrupt? And that was the issue. I'd spent years arguing with them about trying to resolve this in my own mind.
Did it change your relationship? I mean, how did they convince you, or did you convince
them?
They
convinced me initially that I thought that's true. There is a deep ethical corruption inside of this project in which I'm actually aligning gameplay with an actual war scenario. And the way I resolved it was that I thought that that corruption was the very heart and soul of the project. It was that conflict of gaming, the distancing that comes from the fantasy of gaming itself, and then the reality of this real-life situation in which gaming actually functions as well. I mean, all these battles have been played on gaming tables in war colleges.
You could drone the people who sit in America looking at
it. Exactly. That's it. Yeah. That's exactly what happens.
So there is a gaming component to actual war, and I decided to let these ethical, kind of complications stay in the work, let its corruption kind of be on its surface, and that's what the work would be about. It would be about putting the viewer in the situation of feeling incredibly conflicted about watching this, enjoying it, being disturbed about it, and that it would set up a kind of conundrum that couldn't be solved.
Well, I'm liking this because in a sense that was turned into our very aim as well. It's why we stayed out of the way.
Yeah.
And we too have been in arguments with very nice people who essentially said the same thing about, am I wrong, Jean? This sounds
no.
Eerily similar.
It's very similar
to the struggles that we had with this work.
I mean, I think that two things have come up. One is that they're linked, the two issues that have come up. And which is that it's very sanitary, the Flatland project, in that there's no pointing to the realities of the conflict on the ground, and specifically how it affects people, non-Americans, and the people on the ground in the conflict areas themselves. And, for the very same reasons, I think that was very intentional, because the piece is about this relationship of this construction of this world where everything is sanitized. And rather than trying to unmask that in some way and say, look, this is what's really happening, this is not what's really happening, I think we were more interested in looking at how that construction, how that world, that constructed world functions and exists, and what it does, what purpose does it serve for the people who are using these flat characters? And then for what purpose did it serve the government to sponsor Flat Stanley before he went into the war zone? What purpose? And I think that to allow the viewer to reflect upon that rather than to...
agree with it.
Or point to it in a very kind of didactic way.
Well, I think it's a great project. And I guess it is a single project.
Thank you.
as is Brian, so now I'm going to allow you...
I don't think we need to keep going. I'd like to open it up.
I would like...
What do you want to do?
I just want to show the two other...
Really?
Yeah, I really do.
Okay.
because I think I am... I think that I started out talking about this interest I think both John and I have been deeply involved in questions around photography and re-photography throughout our whole artistic lives, sometimes when working on projects together, but also independently. Photography has taken up a lot of our imagination. And how archives work, and it's something that we continue to be really interested in. And so just we're looking at these other archives that have come up online recently, and I just wanted to share them with you because I think you might find them interesting as well. And I think they do, we're not working with them in any way, but they're very interesting archives that exist that relate to the kind of material, but function quite differently than the flat.
And this will be really quick, because we just want to get these on the table and start thinking about, again, how potent photographs remain when it's a matter of their circulation, of testimony, of the mobilization of affect, and how they, as artifacts, as things you can hold in your hand, still have some kind of life and do
things you
a
can
lot
hold in your hand, or that you can send over the internet and hold in your hand on your iPhone.
There's always a material support somewhere, right? So just briefly, there are two Tumblrs. This is a Tumblr.
Explain what a Tumblr
is. Tumblr is a microblogging platform that's the equivalent of Twitter, but with a little bit more meat in it. So images and longer story forms. But this one, Dear Photograph, started in May of 2011 by a guy who one day just took a picture of that his mother had kept of his brother at a table having birthday cake. And then he put up a Tumblr, and it's a simple prompt: take a picture of a picture from the past and the present. Take a picture of a picture from the past and the present. Mm-hmm. And since May, maybe one a day, because he's curating them, these images have been put online, and they're all, I want to say, so easily potent, because they're so easy to fall into, so easy that Chevrolet did an ad campaign essentially lifting the structure of Dear Photograph. But they're also, they reveal the very gap they're trying to fill between the what was and the now of the hand that could be attached to a body, the other hand of which is taking a picture. So that whole setup is visible and available to us.
And there's something very, photographs are always, I think, are very charged in terms of their relation to time, and these photographs flatten this time relationship between when the two images were taken.
That these photographs are usually accompanied with captions and with comments, and they are reblogged, they're circulated through the microblogging site. And his own website, which he started on a lark, has become one of the most highly trafficked, that's the wrong word, visited sites on the internet. Probably not now, but certainly in September. When I read an article about it. But these are a few. We're going to run a slideshow a little bit later.
We'll let them run when we converse a little bit more and open it up for questions.
Tumblr I wanted to show is the, again, you're probably all familiar with this one as well, We Are the 99%, which was started by a guy named Chris and a woman named Priscilla Grimm. it's a fantastic name, Priscilla Grimm. In August, they conceived it and started in early September, before September 17th, which was the first day of Occupy Wall Street. And now, here we are in November, late November, there are over 3,000 individual posts that have been put up. And the prompt for this Tumblr, and this is really a narrative, it's not the prompt on the site, get a bunch of people to submit their pictures with a handwritten sign explaining how these harsh financial times have been affecting them, have them identify themselves as the 99%, and then write OccupyWallStreet.org at the end. And what's interesting is not only the obvious inventiveness of everyone's response to that, it's the proliferation of the handwritten note, like what handwriting still means for us is the voice, singularity, me, mine. It's also that these sometimes long, very long, sometimes large, sometimes small, handwritten notes are often written in the first person, but they're also sometimes generalized to a we, the we that is becoming, the we that's not just the we of complaint, but the we of affiliation according to circumstance. And we'll look at some of these individually. We're also interested in that something is being held in front of the camera, typically occluding most of the face, if not all of it, with some differences and distinctions. And just to make this a little bit more complicated, lest you think that the good guys, quote unquote, only do this. This is a Tea Party inspired Tumblr that's called "We Are the 53% for the allegedly 53% of Americans who pay income taxes." But in their version, it's usually "pay taxes," but of course, it's not. And they have one too, which is nowhere near as hot in terms of the posts, but it's not insubstantial in terms of the numbers. But that shouldn't necessarily be a gauge. And I go here to remind myself that the formal dimension of the practice is not the way to take a measure of anything politically. Not in an easy way. I'd be happy to go through them and try to make some distinctions between the two bodies.
But they are formally quite different.
Are they? Good.
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, the text fills up most of the image in the Tea Party ones.
One of the things that I think is interesting about these and is the idea of the caption. And in the 99%, the text is the caption. And it is the photograph. So the narrative that comes out of these, there's the individual narrative of each individual person that then constructs this cultural narrative. And how that moves back and forth. And I'm interested in these because the narrative supersedes the image.
Yeah.
It becomes the narrative. The narrative becomes the most important element. The image is the narrative. And I think that relationship between image and narrative is something very, very compelling in all of these archives of images that we're looking at and fascinated by.
Yeah, and the mode of address here, it's kind of interesting. To whom are these addressed? There's an anonymous addressee. The caption does become the image, but it's also a vocalization, or at least the figure of a vocalization of a speech to someone. But it's also not a speech to, quote unquote, the 1%. It's really a speech to those who could affiliate, those who could find either something of their own voice in this voicing. In this one in particular,
yeah,
that someone
this,
can...
This one also, yeah. It could be a mask, an anarchist mask over the
face, yeah. The nose below. I also am interested, but this isn't my observation. Judith put a lot of pressure on this, so I'll give her credit. The change from the "I am a 21-year-old college student," which connotes a singularity, like that's the first person that I can own,
right.
Ends with a "I am the 99%, which is now the sharing of something above and beyond that, that the fantasy of singularity. It's
right.
A singularity that's can nominate as well its plurality and pluralize. Pluralized maybe precisely because of the mask. But the mask
perhaps
is also...
Perhaps a new notion of collectivity that is based upon singularity. 99% of the population coheres around their singularity, their disenfranchisement.
So we can just run more of these and talk briefly, if we need to, about that. I'm happy to move to Dear Photograph as well.
Why don't we move to Dear Photograph the
That's
impulse to read will be and
strong.
that will
for
be
all readers here.
Well, I always will read before I'll talk, and if I'd be I so welcome any comments from anyone who's here.
This is the primal scene of your photograph, the very first your photograph. Yeah, I'm happy to, should we open? I don't know what our time is running, Aaron. Is this a, should we open this up to questions? You're not going to speak because you don't want to interrupt the dialogue, do you? You can answer.
Do you want them to speak for a few more minutes?
Yeah, well, right. What do people want? What do you want?
You really, it's a terrible question to ask. You should just compel them.
Yes, all right. That's always better.
That's what you taught me. John.
I was going to say, we've now established that you're a quartet of moral artists or commentators. And as part of that quartet, who are probably not part of the 99%, but probably over the 94%, which is the 99% being misnomer, probably, as yes, well paid faculty members that are not part of the protest movement in reality. I wonder what your comment is about the percentages, the immorality of playing with flatland and games in a society that's bleeding and really hurting. And I think that, I don't know if you want to address the walk on Wall Street or what. Obviously, the goals of Wall Street have been criticized severely as not being crystallized as well. But I think the four of you as being well-paid faculty members could talk about your position as to whether you really would kind of relate to the movement in reality or just on the sidelines extracting more money to raise college students who will then be unemployed and not be...
John, I don't think I can answer that question because you've already answered it for us.
I'm floating the question out for you.
That is not a float. That is a bomb. That's a bomb that you just dropped on us. I mean, because I think your commentary stands alone. Don't you think?
Well, what's your next step then?
As artists?
As the immoral quartet.
Do we need to say yes to that name?
I think you need to convert or transform to something we can all be proud of.
Okay. Well, that we hope
we hope to someday make
orders.
You proud, John.
Well, you make me proud because I respect you. I think it's a person. Other than that, it's just because I am a person. So.
Well, someday I hope to make you proud.
I don't like it.
Anybody else?
Karen.
This presentation made me think about when we cut out photographs and the scale of what we cut out and when we cut out large photographs and when we cut out small photographs. And I was thinking that in the wars of the 20th century, many of the wars, the photographs that people have taken with them to war have been miniature photographs that they've worn inside something in a private space as a memorial. And you have the Imperial War Museum and different kind of... war spaces kind of collect those mementos. And I'm wondering, to me, these large-scale cutouts evoke things like, I don't know, Arnold Schwarzenegger meeting himself in Total Recall in the video store, or, maybe I'm misremembering that sequence.
You're talking about the Flat Daddy.
Yeah, the Flat Daddies, the large, figures that are life-size, or the kind of figures on like Blackpool Beach that you stick your head through and
exactly.
become or have a photograph next to, or waxwork dummies and things like that. And I'm wondering what you could say. I mean, and then there's this very small-scale cutout, non-photographic figure that gets sent or re-photographed. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about both the act of cutting out a photograph and what difference scale makes and how you thought about that as you were making this work.
Do you mean the scale that we present the work at, or do you
no,
mean
the scale of the photographs themselves? And I mean, obviously, that scale changes as they get re-photographed; it gets miniaturized again.
Right.
But there's a sense of things that are either miniaturized in relation to the scale of the living body, or And actually, this also made me think about the Abu Ghraib photographs and how prevalent the act of posing with. Has become in this war, and it's deeply disturbing, I think, to put all of these types of images together and see the formal resonances among them and think about when we photograph objects as if they were people and when we photograph people as if they were objects in the same wars.
I think that the question of scale comes up in... In the narration, she talks about taking the Sharpie on the edge of the photograph to make that It's in part to make it so that it integrates better with the with the scene that the cutout is in. It's also serves scale as well. It helps if you don't have that cutout space. The scale relationships blend better. And in those Flat Daddy photographs, there's a real attempt by the people who are making those photographs to scale themselves in relation, and they get actually instructed on how to make scale. Like if you tip it forward, it's going to be more in scale. And I think that idea of finding oneself in relationship to both a scene and a fictional, you know, or another photograph, and that's what's also happening here with these photographs. They're all trying to get the scale just right so it fits.
But my feeling on looking at the Flat Daddy images, and maybe some of you who looked at them can confirm this for me, is that they're always a little bit larger than life. They're a little bit too big, the daddies.
The dads, yeah.
And I think that's probably not a mistake. Right. I think that it's a little bit of a visual compensation. You could read it as compensation. But I mean, your observation about the labor on scale, I mean, it's really interesting because the Stanleys are always tiny, and it's the virtue, because you can put them in an envelope. So I think playing with scale, it doesn't sometimes produces anxieties of getting it just right, but other times is one is completely free to transform anything into anything else. Like the work of translation doesn't seem to produce, or maybe it's just obvious. Maybe the closer it gets, the weirder it gets. And so the closer it gets to verisimilitude, to being a substitution, like no one can take Stanley and turn him into a boy, easily into a boy. And so it doesn't fall into the uncanny valley, right, where I think we all know that little term. It's not so close and yet then producing anxiety about being a double.
I think scale is also really important in your project. And Brian, would you like to say something in response to Karen's question?
Well, I mean, the scale in Miniature War in Iraq was really... I mean, I just like the image of these players going in with their hands and moving these figures into battle with each other, and just the kind of the signifier of control, of there being outside control that is actually making this whole scenario work. And I also like the dislocating Alice in Wonderland effect as well. I think that, I mean, I was really trying to dislodge the position of the viewer and cause dis-ease, both morally as well as physically. Mm-hmm. So this scale shift was really interesting. I mean, there were interesting perceptual things that happened, like if you drop down towards the level of the table, the scale of everything just magnified enormously.
You could see in the projection, the rear projection.
Yeah, you could almost imagine being sort of right in there, and it was a strange world to be inside of, because there are all of these, like, as Kaju was saying, all the miniature soldiers have a lot of defects on them, and, you know, all the buildings are handmade with tons of defects. So you're in this defective world that you can actually almost imagine yourself being part of, and of course, that's the defective world of war, and the kind of world that is constructed by politicians for a certain percentage of the population to go and inhabit. So it just seemed like an appropriate thing, and it had this psychological value of dislocation, which was really kind of the prime effect that I was going for in the project.
Yeah, and location seems to be a good word for its derivatives for thinking about this tumbler too. Mm-hmm. Relocation. What's happening in the matching up of the photograph with its surroundings?
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm interested in this cluster, in this tumbler of the pilgrimage to the place, like the place that one must return, and measure the difference between a then and a now, but only authentically by being there. In some sense, by standing in the same place that the camera had been
putting yourself back into the position of the camera. The camera will be located, if not exactly, then somewhere close to where it was. So the act of taking the picture has its own durability. It calls for reenactment. And most of the time, though, it's being reenacted by someone either in the picture, like that little girl is now holding the camera looking, yeah, right? So there's dislocation of the eye. It's not the same photographer, dislocation of time. Yeah. The attempt to relocate and stitch together a loss.
Yeah.
And the gap. And the gap is made visible in these. Even though they are reparative, the gap is, even you could say the margin of that, the border of that image that separates it, keeps it that way. Someone else? The question or comment?
I have a question. I'm finding my location was exactly my question. Mm. I'm finding myself disoriented and trying to figure out where I am as the audience. In these things. This, in the Flat Daddy, you said that they're instructed to place them X and Y. Who's the they? What is the project, and who's the they in that project?
Well, the I think what you meant is that the kit that you get that tells you, gives you instructions on how to properly place for the sake of taking a photograph of that, of the Flat Daddy. It also just tells you how to fabricate it.
Okay, so that in fact, for this project, there's a kit of instructions,
yes,
that you participate in or choose not to, but presumably for this, that's what you're seeing.
As in the Tumblr, both Tumblrs, there is a specific prompt that people are eagerly, with appetite, taking up.
And the, right? Part of the instructions here was to go back and try and...
Take a picture of a picture from the past and the present. Take a picture.
But in those words, I wouldn't know to line up the fence.
I think it's right. So it's not entirely. There were exemplars. That one, the primal scene of the, which I suppose is the primal scene of all of these images. It's the lost child. It's that child that one reaches back to discover and put in his or her place.
But they're incredibly expert at lining up a lot of these things. They're amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't have thought to do that if I was trying to respond to that. Tumblr. And then, Brian, for your project also, who makes the landscape? Where does that start?
It's the gamers themselves, so it's entirely in their hands. And so I don't really have any input outside of facilitating them.
But there were gamers working on that project that you joined.
I joined and helped out. I tried to facilitate. But it's really the character of the whole thing is theirs. And as a sculptural object, they're the authors of that object.
So it was Iraq. They were doing that already. Because you said there was friction between you and the gamers over making it present. But they were already looking at Iraq. They just didn't want it to be today.
They would not have played a game about Iraq themselves. But I basically talked them into it. And then they worked on the diorama and built...
Because you talked them into it.
Because it was strictly because of that. And they regretted it in the end. So... There are so many regrets around the whole project. And once again, I think that's an appropriate set of conditions for what this project is addressing. And once again, it raises so many confusions in the viewer. And I think the war in Iraq is like about as confusing an occurrence as I have known about since the war in Vietnam. So it merits a treatment like this.
And then my last piece to the same question is, so then my experience of that project is as a video of the reenacting of the enacting of this game.
the show that we just did in New York had two parts. There was a performance. Okay. So there was a new performance of a scenario in Afghanistan. And we brought in new researchers who spoke the language to and researched for that project. But what you see when you enter, unless it's during the performance, you see the actual diorama that's just stopped at the end of one of the games. Then there are these scale-distorting photographs, which are portraits of the little toy soldiers, and then a large video projection. It was huge in New York. It was like 45 feet across. I mean, it was really considerable. And so you just have this collision of media, and it's supposed to be hallucinatory and dislocating, and then hopefully it's meant to kind of bridge this gap between you know, reality and the fantasy you bring to the game and to the observation of the work of art, and to just intermix them in a way that can't be pulled apart, basically.
Where is that piece? Sorry.
It was shown, well, the first one was done in Las Vegas. The gamers invited me to go to a national convention with them, and it was right in the center of a big convention center in Las Vegas, and we played it as part of a national convention. And then it was shown at Yerba Buena, which is a museum in San Francisco, and then at Pierogi Gallery in Brooklyn in New York. And
thanks.
That's where it happened.
Other questions or comments? Robin?
I'm interested in your photograph and also of Flatlands, the work that goes into the photograph that you don't see, and especially how digital cameras might allow for that. Like how in your photograph, the original is this print photograph that was probably just a one shot or maybe a couple. But the digital's now, like, they could be taking a whole series of photographs with their digital camera working to get it right. And I'm interested in, like, all the detritus from the piece that doesn't get seen. And I think that could also apply to Flatlands, too, how they're, like, positioning and, you know, maybe taking multiple sets of photographs, but then one gets chosen.
So
I guess, like, the work that goes into the piece versus the piece itself and, like, knowing the story behind it. Do you have any comment on that, and also, like, how the digital plays a role in that?
Well, I mean, two things to say. One, I like the idea of being able to uncover, do an archaeological work that would uncover all that, the detritus, the conditions of possibility, which are, in this case, lots of pictures, lots of failures, lots of attempts. And it's, for the sake of the Tumblr, for the sake of the submission, it's cleaned up. Whereas what I like about the I Am the 99% Tumblr is that they're, it's handwritten and there are lots of errors and things that get scrubbed out. And you get this feeling, at least, and maybe it's just because I haven't thought about it the way you're prompting me to think about it, that it's so immediate that it could not possibly have been done twice. It's in that way the equivalent to a voice. That's one thought. And the other thought, which I'm not going to be able to recover, about Dear Photograph or about Flatland, about production. No, I don't have it. I think it's all gone. Anybody?
Well, we shouldn't end on that note.
No, we're not. But I don't have yet. Taya? And Fareed?
You started off talking about archives.
Yes.
And I was wondering if we could talk about this in terms of an archive, because when I think of an archive, I think of, you know, if we archive letters or photographs, those are very personal objects that then belong to everyone when they're archived, and we have access to them, and we can read letters that someone, one person wrote to another. It was a very private thing, and then it becomes something public. So could we, like, apply that to this kind of Tumblr archive?
I was cautious when I showed these on another occasion to not use the word archive, precisely because I didn't want to too quickly presume that the conditions for archivization were in place, that there are the answers to, that they would, you find them when you've asked a question, that they can be lost in the way that something, like the archive is the way you lose things, it's not the way you find things, or you have to think of the losses, and Robin's question was going in this direction. As you think of their accessibility, archives become thick and opaque, and they don't give you what you want. The fantasy is that everything is there, but the stuff that comes from it comes on its own time and its own place. So I don't know. I think archive is probably a lazy thing to say about this, for maybe some of the reasons you've articulated, that they don't yield to the kind of questioning that you posed, and they're not gathering up just about everything. There's a pre-selection of what's going to count. In both We Are the 99 and in the Dear Photograph, there's a curator. And the curator says, no, I'm sorry, we can't publish this one because they can't read your handwriting. Or the submissions to Dear Photograph, according to the person who started it, run to 30 or 40 a day, but only one or two show up. So if you say archive, you have presumed something about completeness, when in fact there is, and that accessibility
So I don't think these are responding to an archival motive. So I kind of want to take the word back without taking back the desire that the archive produces of wanting to see through it and wanting to make sense of it. So I want to make sense of the proliferation of the first person and the first person plural in these images, as well as in the voice that is there and the kind of affiliation that is not, it's a kind of collectivity that's not the collectivity of the totalitarian state. It's a new mode of collectivity that's being articulated in these, that we're all answering to in some way, or being called to answer to. So I don't want to lose the archive, but it's probably too easy to simply say they're archives because there are a lot of images that share some trait.
Yeah, and there's some instability about this material, the fact that it's that things are dropping out and other things are being added that defies the synchronic logic of an archive. Hmm. A kind of unclassifiability, a different temporality. Hmm. I think we maybe have time for one more question.
Can I just ask a question about, because you're kind of suggesting that archives can't be self-organized? Is that what you were suggesting? You're talking about collectivities that were creating this array of photographs.
No, I see that point. That's a good one. But no, I wasn't saying anything that smart. I think I was simply saying that we do care about, or I care about this. I don't have to care about it as an archive to care about some features that I'm trying to make legible and read in them. Mm-hmm. So I just don't. I'm worried that in saying archive too quickly, it preconditions the way that one would encounter it.
However, I'm not afraid of the word archive. And I'm actually really interested in how the notion of the archive is shifting and changing with contemporary modes of collecting and disseminating images. And so I think it's kind of fluid right now, what an archive is and what the definition of it is. I think it's changing all the time, and very, very quickly. So I like to use that word because it puts me into the position of having to truly address what it is that I define as that, and what our culture defines in that, and who has the right to claim something to be an archive, who you know, plenty of curators put together and select materials for an archive. So that's why I like to use the word.
So Laura, let me add a detail then.
Maybe there's one distinction. Question.
I know. With, yeah. Over here. But I want to only respond to Jean.
Okay.
With another thought.
So, all right.
Thank you. So during the conversation at Bryn Mawr about the We Are the 99%, someone remarks rightly after I said, look, all these are in the Tumblr, the text is repeated as a caption. And she smartly said, look, that's because they need to be searchable, machine searchable. Handwriting's not machine searchable. That means now I'm happy to use the word, the archive precedes their installation in the fabric of the internet because it must be searchable. That's like that would be a condition of archivization, that it be
legible.
Digital archivization, that it be machine readable. So once you've decided that, then the form, it's like the way that the form of the object in the archive is deformed in order for it to fit. And so the fact that these have captions, which I just thought was a convenient way of making it legible to me, was in fact not making it legible to me. It was making it legible for search engines that need to find it. And so if anything you search for online is tagged and is conditioned such that it can be found, then it's the condition of its possibility within the archive is already structured by a kind of questioning that the internet does very well so far, or does well in some ways. I'm sure handwriting will be solved, and this will disappear as a particular precondition for its insertion. So, I mean, that's one another way, a different way to think about archive, and maybe I'd be happier to use it with that valence. Fareed. Take us out, Fareed.
Yeah. I'm just interested in the fact that when in this and the one impression, I mean, there are many things that remain, but I'm interested in the fact that almost all of them start with I'm or I or I am, and because of the speed at which they're rotating, the word that stays, I mean, they're incredible, they're wonderful, but I'm wondering if there's some if the individualism that comes out, yeah. or if it becomes a kind of a reverse commentary on American individualism or something, because it's all about these individual experiences that are kind of cascading before you at the speed. So that's the impression. I'm wondering if that's deliberate.
How are they? What's the reverse individuality or the?
Well, I mean, it's a dystopian individualism on some level, right? It's about, you know, it's about a society in which everyone has. It's taking a certain narrative and it's inverting it, at least implicitly, because you have all these individual stories that are declaring themselves as individual stories because they all start with the word I or I am, but that's not how those stories are supposed to end. So it becomes very interesting, and especially because of the speed at which they're going, that's the one thing that remains, because you can't actually read most of the narratives to the end. But maybe that's an effect. Maybe that does.
And I can either apologize and or say that I willfully made that the speed of the slideshow fast, so fast that you would have to abstract.
Because I know how you feel about narrative also.
You do, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
I think what is really striking about this series is that the things that are definitive of the I, of the writers, of the letters, are the qualities that would normally result in them being excluded, a kind of scapegoated, marginalized figures, the things that would mark them outside of the social or the majority. Yeah. And what's so moving about them is that is becoming the condition of membership for it.
Right.
And so it's not just singularity, it's marked, there are social markers there that are undergoing some quite extraordinary transformation.
Right.
So Aaron now has the...
Right, I was wondering if you could share with us, maybe as a last series of remarks, some of the thinking and the generative principles behind ECHO,
yes.
Which seems to be, in a certain sense, building upon the kind of conversation that we've been having here, but in the service of actually a new institutional formation that would not just be about the production of another extraordinary research practice turned artistic work, but something fundamentally collective that's both the archivization, as I understand it, of contemporary Iraqi art, but also trying to facilitate the production of new work more generally. So I don't know if you could just share this, maybe as an ending remark, what's been going on.
I mean, what it is.
Okay, I'll tell you what it is. I guess what this whole conversation has made me think about some of the virtues of flatness, about what you can do if you collapse possibility and collapse the image, collapse a human into a photograph. And ECHO is a project that actually does that, but it does it to good effect, I hope. And what ECHO is it's basically an organization put together by me and a friend of mine who's Iraqi and who's a curator and an arts administrator. And ECHO is an organization that's devoted to contemporary Iraqi art. And it has a range of things that this organization is involved with. It's a website that aims to bring the Iraqi artists in the diaspora together with the few remaining artists who are left in Baghdad primarily and bring them into conversation with each other. It's a place that is meant to document and archive contemporary Iraqi art wherever it happens, whether it's in Iraq itself or anywhere in the world by artists in the diaspora. And then the third and kind of largest part of the project, and the one that we're involved with right now, is to start an art school in Baghdad, which we've already begun. And the art school has a physical location in Baghdad itself, in a classroom. But all the classes are conducted essentially, primarily online. So the teaching artist can be anywhere in the world and be projected into this classroom through, you know, conferencing software like Skype. We've got a special interface that we've designed that brings Skype together with Vimeo, which is an HD video site, and Flickr, which you can have high quality images there as well, and then room for PDFs and texts and all kinds of other materials. So it's an interface that can be used both by the teaching artist and by the students in the classroom. And they conduct full out, you know, lectures and conversations. The students have their work critiqued because the students can upload their work onto this interface, onto this website. And we just began this thing about a week and a half ago, and we had our first class in Baghdad that was conducted by an Iraqi artist, Wafa Bilal, who works and teaches in New York. Our second class was actually today by a young Iraqi artist, and we're having a whole series of classes that will go on for the entire year. And it's free to all the students who are involved, and we're just doing it as a service to the contemporary art community in Iraq and to the future community that could be evolved by participating in the program. So we've gotten funding from the Netherlands. This is a super low-cost thing to do because we're just running a website and creating software that's being donated by friends of mine in San Francisco. Yeah, so it's like flexible. It's also kind of an interesting structure because it's really the only way that you could really construct a functioning school at this point in a war-torn city like Baghdad, and do it on a very high level, even despite these terrible physical and political circumstances that the art school has to exist within. So I don't know. Is that enough?
You have brochures?
I have two left.
Could I have
one? Yeah. Anybody who wants to see these, and there's a website as well. It's echoiraq.org, so you can see pretty much what we're doing. And I think this is also an interesting example of a project that is just cooked up by two people who, I mean, we're not doing this through any institutional affiliations. No one's getting paid. It's just, you know, we went out and fundraised for this thing. We're making it happen. We found contacts and people to support it in Baghdad. And it's happening even though there's like almost no infrastructure here. And I think it can potentially have a huge amount of impact for the small community of artists that are still in Baghdad.